Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll speak for a few minutes. Don't let that worry you. Take a moment, counsel. Take a seat. Get comfortable. I'll ask the marshal to call the second case in our calendar.
Calling case number A230514 in the matter of the welfare of PJB Child.
And counsel, I'll just make a couple of additional remarks while you settle in. So first of all, I will ask you, welcome. We're looking forward to our conversation. I'll ask you, as you get to the podium, to do a couple of things. First of all, please remember to identify yourself as well as the client you represent. We do make an audio recording of today's argument. It is available on the court's website. It helps keep our record clean if you do that. And then secondly, please keep an eye on the clock. It'll be visible to you at the podium. You can make adjustments in the podium. Take your time to do that. But do notice the clock. It tends to go quickly. We do so enjoy getting a chance to talk to counsel about our important cases. So with that, counsel for appellant, we're ready for you when you are.
May it please the court, my name is Christina Zahar, and I represent juvenile appellant PJB. In this case, the district court abused its discretion when it disregarded the expert conclusions presented at the certification trial and granted the state's motion to certify appellant for adult prosecution. There are several undisputed points in this appeal. So first, it is undisputed that appellant's case was a presumptive certification. That means he was 17 years old at the time of the offense, and the alleged offense of third-degree murder carries a presumptive prison commit under the adult sentencing guidelines, which makes the state a presumptive adult certification. We also do not dispute that in a presumptive certification trial, appellant bore the burden of rebutting that presumption by clear and convincing evidence that retaining the proceeding in juvenile court would serve public safety. And of course, both parties agree that the public safety factors, there are six of them, those are enumerated in Juvenile Statute 260B.125, Subdivision 4. Of those six factors, there are three that we disagree with the court's decision on that led the district court to certify PJB into adult certification. So those are factor three, the prior record of delinquency, and factors five and six, the adequacy of available punishment, programming, and dispositional options. Appellant's position in arguing post-certification trial was actually consistent with the forensic psychologist's analysis and conclusions. And we actually found that some of the factors did weigh in certification in the favor of certification for this juvenile, but agreed with the expert forensic psychologist appointed by the court as the court's own expert in the factors that weighed in favor of extended juvenile jurisdiction, and then ultimately a final conclusion that that presumption was rebutted by the juvenile at trial in favor of extended juvenile jurisdiction. I'll begin by discussing public safety factor number three, which was the juvenile's prior record of delinquency. The court ruled that this factor weighed in favor of adult certification, even though the court-appointed expert, the forensic psychologist, concluded that it weighed in favor of extended juvenile jurisdiction. What was interesting in this case factually is that both experts, Dakota County Corrections, who was the probation officer and her team, as well as the forensic psychologist, completed their reports for presumptive certification, and both of them actually determined that extended juvenile jurisdiction was supported by public safety factor number three after their initial reports. It wasn't until after the certification trial had begun, after testimony had begun, that the district court ordered both the experts to reevaluate public safety factor number three in their reports, that the decision of corrections changed to recommend certification. So that is really
what happened with the forensic psychologist with that order.
Yep, so the forensic psychologist, she, even though the court ordered her to reevaluate factor number three, she wrote back to the court, she submitted a letter to the court saying that she had already considered those pending petitions and it did not change her ultimate recommendation of EJJ as she had already considered those matters. And so her final conclusion supporting EJJ remained the same, but probation's recommendation changed from EJJ to adult certification as a result of the court order, ordering them to reevaluate that third public safety factor.
So where is the abuse of discretion, counsel, on factor number three?
So the abuse of discretion here under factor number three is that the court actually ordered corrections to go against their practice in hundreds to thousands of other juvenile certification matters. And the probation officer actually testified that she has never considered pending offenses in the hundreds of reports.
And this was fully argued as a motion before the court, right?
Fully argued,
all
correct.
Right. So that is all a matter of record, so I'm still trying to understand how this becomes an error or an abuse of discretion for the district court to direct probation to consider the prior record, given that it's a factor in the statute.
Sure.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
well,
yeah.
So why this is important is because there's no case law supporting considering these pending petitions when they're pending petitions post-offense. And that's what's unique in this case. And so the alleged murder three occurred in April 2022. And then the other petitions that were considered but still pending at the time of the certification trial occurred later in time from that murder three case.
Right. So your question now is, what does prior mean?
That's a big part of the argument. Absolutely.
All right. So what do you think prior means?
Prior means pre-offense conduct.
And what case law do you rely on for that? Because, of course, there's been quite a bit of discussion in the briefs. I've read the cases.
There is.
Our records in the past have included offenses, but prior record from quite a range of time.
They do. Yeah. And all the cases that we could find, the records that were included were pre-offense petitions. So we weren't able to find cases that included pending petitions that were post-offense conduct. Cases
and you made this argument to the district court?
Because I
saw that in your reply brief that you're making this argument about what is a prior offense and that it has to be prior to the offense that is currently being adjudicated, so the event that's currently being adjudicated for the purposes of the certification motion. I didn't see it in your opening brief. I saw a different argument, and maybe I'm missing something, so help me out there.
Thank you, Judge. Yes, so what we did mention in our opening brief is we knew the state would be relying on the NJS case, and NJS actually is discussing whether uncharged behavioral incidents at school can be considered prior juvenile conduct. And so we dispute that analysis can be applied here, because what that court was considering actually had nothing to do with records that were in the juvenile court system. It had to do with uncharged behavioral school-related incidents. So any language from that NJS case involving what records means, right, juvenile records, is primarily dicta. They weren't actually analyzing the issue of what it means for a prior record to be applied in public safety factor number three. We also cite the KAP case, and that would have been cited in our initial brief as well as the reply brief as well. And the KAP case is also a juvenile certification trial. Like PJB, it's a presumptive certification. It's also a murder charge. And that court actually does analyze two prior assaults that were pending at the time of the homicide. So again, it's specific in the language of those decisions.
It's specific in the language of the decisions. I think I know what you're saying. It's specific in that when the prior pending cases occurred, I think is clear in KAP. There is no discussion of what does the word prior mean.
Correct.
In this factor number three.
That's correct.
Am I right?
Okay. Absolutely. None of these cases. So there's primarily three to four cases, and that's all we're talking about.
Sure.
So there's KAP, NJS, and then St. Louis County versus SDS.
So it sounds to me, but correct me if I'm wrong, that this your argument about defining prior to be an offense before that occurred before the offense under adjudication, so before the offense for which certification is being sought. What law would you base that on? We don't have any case law that governs it, right?
That's correct, Judge.
Okay.
What it seems in these three cases, four if you include an unpublished case, is that it's always assumed to be a given, is how I read those cases. It's a given that we're talking about pre-offense conduct when we're talking about prior records of juvenile delinquency. And that is how these courts have treated the issue. It hasn't been argued specifically with the definition of the word prior.
You think it's assumed by the courts?
I believe it's assumed as a given,
okay.
Correct.
Another interpretation would be that the term is broad, prior.
That would be another interpretation, but in KAP, they actually specifically in St. Louis County versus SDS, they specifically ignored pending petitions that were post-offense and only included pending petitions that were pre-offense conduct in their analysis.
But without discussion.
They do discuss that they ignored it.
So, counsel, I need more than that for us to rule in your favor, right? I need some analysis of why the law would favor your position. It can't simply be silence or failure to discuss a factor in the case law.
Well, the word that's used in the statute is prior. And that word to me
But it's prior to what is the question, right?
Right.
Yeah, right. So
it's to me that word is unambiguous. It's prior juvenile delinquency records is the phrasing that the statute uses. Mm-hmm. And in this case, there were no prior juvenile delinquency records other than traffic offenses, minor traffic offenses.
At the time of the offense, but not at the time of the proceedings.
That's correct, Judge, yes.
So I'm not sure how, when you say it's unambiguous, in the word prior is the only thing that's not ambiguous. The question is prior to what? That's the ambiguity, the word prior itself. So I'm not sure that the point you were just making, or the argument you just made, makes the point.
Thank you. Yes, I do understand what you're saying. And I would again refer back to the SDS case in which they specifically do disregard the post-offense pending petition.
On your earlier argument about the district court abusing its discretion by rejecting certain testimony, how would you define the limits of the district court's discretion in deciding what testimony the probation officer, the expert witnesses, to accept or reject?
Judge, I would define that as it's the court's role to weigh the evidence that's been presented to the court, but the court was not in a position to conduct its own evaluation of the juvenile. It did not do so. And
well, the court is entitled to reject testimony. I mean, even if it's unopposed testimony, the court can say, I'm not persuaded, right? So I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about that, I'm just trying to understand how you would ask us to define, where you're asking us to say, the district court abused its discretion
sure.
by asking for more review, by not accepting testimony. How would we frame a limit on the district court's discretion?
Sure. Well, in this case, Judge, there was no testimony or evidence presented that supported the district court's conclusions for factors 5 and 6. So the court, for example, expressed that there was a concern regarding whether the period of time until the juvenile was 21 was sufficient for programming, but that was despite three witnesses, including the court's own witness, saying there is sufficient time. No one had that concern that there wasn't sufficient time. Probation felt there was sufficient time. The forensic psychologist felt there was sufficient time. And then the court also received specific program information from individual at the DOC Red Wing facility for juveniles about what that looks like when a juvenile is committed to the Commissioner of Corrections until the age of 21 in EJJ cases. And so the judge, in weighing the evidence, there was no evidence presented that supported that conclusion. It was, in fact, completely contradictory to all of the evidence presented by the experts.
There was, counsel, in the record, some testimony, I think, from the Blaschko from Red Wing about some uncertainty as to what programming PB would receive if he were placed in Red Wing. Isn't that right?
Well, that's correct, Judge, because they create an individual plan for every inmate that they receive is what Mr. Latchko testified. And so until a juvenile is actually committed to the commissioner, that individual plan is not created. However, he did testify as to a generic individual with the same characteristics as PB. So, for example, convicted of third-degree murder, and we even went further than that. Well, what if there was a domestic assault and a firearm charge as well? And they talked about that individual without using the name PB because an individual plan had not been created for him.
It just seems to me, going back to your legal point, whether the district court abused its discretion on factor number five, it seems to me that although the experts did both, the forensic psychologist and probation did offer the opinion that PB would be able to complete programming, whatever that means, because they also expressed doubt as to what that programming was or how long it would take. None of that had been established yet. The uncertainty alone that was reflected in the testimony and the record lends support to the district court's conclusion that it is not clear whether PB would complete programming.
Thank you. Judge, may I respond to that question?
Please.
Thank you. The information that the court found was questionable or unclear is information that is impossible to know in any case prior to disposition. And so the experts were able to testify about the various dispositional options that are available for a juvenile adjudicated EJJ. But until that juvenile actually has their disposition hearing, there's no way to know what is going to be ruled for that individual. And so that it's an impossibility. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And of course, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Heather Pipenhagen, and I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney here today on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. The district court in this case did not clearly err in its findings on any of the six public safety factors and therefore did not abuse its discretion when it balanced these factors based on the findings and concluded that the appellant had
Doesn't that depend on whether the district court correctly understood prior?
It does. It does, and that goes to whether or not the court clearly erred in its findings. But the standard of review, it is clear error as to the findings on each of the six factors, and then abuse of discretion on how the court balances that after it makes the findings.
Right, but isn't the interpretation of prior, that would be a legal question overlaying the district court's fact-finding, the effect of the fact-finding.
And if the district court didn't properly analyze that factor when it concluded that it supported certification, that would be an error. So this court would have to find that the district court clearly erred in its finding that the prior record supported certification.
Right, but it's a de novo review of whether the district court's understanding of prior.
If there's a legal error.
Right.
Correct. This court can say there was a legal error. And so I'll start with that third factor, the prior record, because obviously the statute tells us that that's one of the two to be weighed the heaviest, and obviously it's critical in this case. There is no case law that supports what appellant is arguing, and that is that the prior record of delinquency has to or can only include petitions that were filed before the offense. That is the subject of the certification. Appellant's counsel did cover, I believe, mentioned three of the published cases that talk about prior offenses, but there was one that was not mentioned that was also public published, and that is RDM, which is another case in which the court considered other offenses that had not yet been adjudicated. And in the RDM case, I just looked back over it during argument, And the facts in as provided in that case don't indicate one way or the other when the offense dates of the North Dakota pending offenses were, at least that I could find when I was just looking at it in the last few minutes. So that would support an argument that the case law doesn't only apply to offenses that occurred after the instant offense.
Was it disputed in that case? I mean, do we have a case at all on point that actually says, all right, now we've got arguments on both sides as to what prior means?
KAP is probably not on the issue of prior, just on the issue of whether or not you can consider petitions prior to adjudication. That is the issue, whether or not you can consider pending petitions that have not yet been adjudicated, but not one that addresses the offense date of that pending petition. I mean, in theory, most of the time you're not going to have that much opportunity or for offenses to occur after a presumptive certification offense, because I think often the juvenile's in custody. But in this case, there was enough time for this appellant to commit three more serious felony offenses. So we have three felony offenses that occurred after the instant offense. So there's no case law that says this has to occur before the instant offense. I think the comparison made in the brief to the sentencing guidelines fails. The sentencing guidelines lay out really clearly how you figure out when points can be assigned versus offense date and sentencing order and things like that. We don't have that in this statute. So that comparison fails. And to find, for this court to find that the pending petition has to have an offense date before the instant offense is contrary to the entire focus of public safety that is the name of these six factors, the six public safety factors. And the case law says that this is the most important consideration. The touchstone of the analysis is public safety. So from that public safety lens, it is no more or less a public safety factor when that pending petition occurred. In other words, if appellant in this case had committed three other felony offenses 3, 4, and 5 days before the instant offense versus 4 to 6 weeks after, is that any different public safety concern to the district court in this case? It's all the same. You're looking at this individual and their conduct.
So, counsel, can you narrow that argument to the actual language of factor three? Instead of focusing on the overall, and I appreciate your reference to public safety. Of course, that is definitely the goal of the six factors. But what about the language itself of factor number three?
The language says prior record of delinquency. The case law has clarified that enough to tell us that includes petitions and adjudications. So that is why KAP, RDM, and the other cases have also looked at petitions that haven't yet been adjudicated. The actual statutory language does not address the issue of what is prior. And I would submit prior is prior to the certification hearing.
So the word prior then is superfluous?
Not necessarily, because you could have an offense that occurred prior to the certification proceedings but hasn't yet been petitioned. So for offenses that are prior, they have to have been petitioned.
Well, then it's not a record of delinquency. I mean, it's a prior record of delinquency.
So the offense has to have been petitioned prior to the certification hearing. It doesn't matter if the offense occurred prior. It has to be petitioned or adjudicated based on the way the case law has interpreted prior record of delinquency.
But if the word prior were not included, wouldn't that cover the same terrain? I'm trying to think of a case that would not be a factor under with the word prior and without the word prior. Give me a circumstance where they would be treated differently.
I can't come up with one as I'm standing here as you're asking that question. I mean, the case law just clearly said that record has to be a petition or an adjudication.
Right, but if the word prior were removed, it would cover everything that you're talking about in the same way.
In theory, I can't say that it would not. I mean, we don't have a case that interprets it without that word, but
I'm just trying to think of a circumstance, not a case. I'm trying to think of a circumstance.
Sure.
And if there's no circumstance, you can't think of one.
I can't.
Shouldn't we assume that the legislature meant something by the word prior?
I think we're supposed to assume that you are correct.
So you agree with Judge Ross that the reference to delinquency, and again, I don't mean to put this on Judge Ross, but we're looking at the language of the statute. One way to look at it is record of delinquency. You say that alone talks about petitions and adjudications. We don't need the word prior to talk about petitions and adjudications.
I would have to look at NJS. The NJS case is the case that established that, and I don't recall off the top of my head, and I don't want you to make while I wait, but I don't know that NJS separated. They used the word record. They didn't address the prior part. They simply analyzed the word record in the beginning part of their analysis, and then they say, we conclude that prior record of delinquency unambiguously refers to records of petitions to juvenile court and the adjudication of alleged violations of the law by minor. So that's when they go on to say, therefore, prior record of delinquency doesn't cover things that happened in school that were never petitioned. So,
but that goes to record of delinquency, not prior.
Correct. However, the public safety analysis, it just would not be rational to only consider conduct that occurred before rather than 4 to 6 weeks after, when the court's whole question is public safety served by keeping this person in the juvenile system?
If it is true that the word prior is superfluous, that why wouldn't that be an argument for the legislature as opposed to for the courts? That you shouldn't make this obligation, shouldn't include that. I mean, you should or shouldn't include it, seems to be.
It's certainly an argument for the legislature, but I think you can also look at the intent of those six public safety factors and what the legislature was asking the district courts to consider. And it just would not make sense to consider offenses only before and not after if public safety is the tantamount concern for the district court.
Counsel, were these arguments raised to the district court about, we're focusing a lot on the word prior. Mm-hmm. It was not raised to the district court.
It was not.
Okay.
I think the focus in district court was to give more credit to Dr. Aiken's conclusion that these are kind of to be disregarded because they were a cluster offense, which clearly the district court rejected that testimony, just fundamentally disagreed with Dr. Aiken's theory that this was just a cluster offense, these three different offenses, a different victim. The district court did not agree. And as to that question, Justice Ross, the district court, and I did include a cite to this in my brief, the weight and credibility to be given to the opinion of an expert does rely exclusively with the fact finder. So the district court, while they are to consider the expert, they certainly don't have to agree and did not in this case.
On the question of when the argument of prior first arrived, is it your position that... there's sort of two questions. Was it argued in the district court? Was it argued in the appellant's moving brief? Or does it just show up in the reply brief? So what's the state's position as to when the argument was first fully presented?
In the reply brief. In the reply brief. It certainly wasn't something that was litigated at the district court level. I think what was addressed at the district...
Sometimes we do consider arguments that are raised for the first time on appeal, but then we have that extra hurdle of, well, raised for the first time on appeal, but you wait until the reply brief. That's another challenge to an appellant.
And the district court simply relied on the argument about whether or not you can consider a pending petition, where we cited in district court that you can under KAP and RDM. Moving, and then even if this court were to find there was clear error with the district court's decision on the prior record issue, that's not dispositive here. That simply splits the two factors that the statute says are to be given the most weight. And the court certainly did not clearly err on the other factors, specifically factor two, which is not disputed, the culpability of the appellant, and then factor five and six, which are the adequacy of punishment and programming, and so then the dispositional programming, options.
Counsel, would you respond to appellant's argument about the both the probation and the forensic psychologist both interpreting factor number five as favoring EJJ in part because PB would complete programming with an EJJ disposition?
So factor five has two parts. It's adequacy of punishment.
It does. Just
and
talk about the programming part.
Correct.
I recognize there are two parts.
Yep, and corrections, I believe, did not believe or necessarily definitively say that it was adequate as far as the punishment aspect of factor five, and neither did the district court. So, I mean, that alone resolves part of factor five. But as to the programming part of factor five, corrections said that they believe there would be time to do the programming. Dr. Aiken also stated in her report that 2 years and 8 months would be enough time to do the programming. So now there's issues. There's issues with the timing, and then there's some issues with the district court's crediting of that opinion. So I'll start with the timing issue. Dr. Aiken said 2 years and 8 months is enough to, would give him enough time to do the programming. That's what was in her report. Well, that is not a helpful statement, because we all know, and the district court well knew, that appellant was not going to have 2 years and 8 months to do programming when Dr. Aiken's writing her report at the point that he has 2 years and 8 months until his 21st birthday. We don't have a determination on certification, and the matter hasn't even been adjudicated. And the district court stated in its order at that point there was 28 months left until appellant's 21st birthday, and that they were not persuaded, appellant had not met his burden to overcome the presumption of certification. And again, I'll get to the reasons why that wasn't overcome, but even at that point, the district court is aware when you're down to 28 months, we still don't even have the court set and this matter hasn't been adjudicated. The relevant question to the expert would have been, what is the minimum amount of time we need for him to complete the programming? And nobody asked the expert what the minimum amount of time was. And the district court, I think based on some of the other statements from Dr. Aiken about past behaviors, the best indicator of future behavior, and her, I think, rather ambiguous statement, there's a good chance he is amenable in the time that is left, simply just wasn't enough for the district court. The bottom line is we have an appellant with a lot of risk and a lot of needs, and there just wasn't a lot of time. And he did not meet his burden in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, we're ready for you for rebuttal.
Thank you. The state argued just now that the focus of public safety is the most important thing in addressing these factors for the court, and that it's irrelevant whether the pending petition is post-offense or pre-offense, but it actually is extremely relevant, and that is the purpose of the discussion of a pattern of offenses that you see in the case law and in Dr. Aiken's analysis. A juvenile is much more dangerous if they continue to commit violent offenses after court intervention. That is absolutely relevant to a determination of public safety. If they're already in the court system, if they're already on probation, and they or on conditional release for that matter, and they continue to commit offenses, that makes them a more dangerous person.
And as I recall, counsel, that comment, you know, the dangerousness of, in this case, PB, because he had not had intervention until this particular matter began to be go through the system. That is raised by Aiken, isn't it right?
Absolutely.
I mean, Aiken presented the district court with that evidence.
That's correct.
Right. So that was considered by the district court.
It was, Judge, and that was.
So that's where I go back to asking, have you really shown an abuse of discretion? Because the district court received this evidence, considered it. It's the district court's position, duty to evaluate it and weigh it. It's not for this court to second guess that weighing. So where does the abuse of discretion fall into play?
The abuse is considering the pending petitions that are pre-offense conduct.
So it turns again to it this argument again. That you made. Great, you know, thank you, don't need to repeat it, about what is the meaning of prior. Okay, so that's where your abuse of discretion rises or falls.
That's, I would say so. I think that's the error of law that occurred in the district court's analysis.
And can you clarify, when do you believe was the first time that argument about prior was fully formed by the appellant?
Judge, the first time is fully formed as far as what's the definition of the word prior would be in the reply brief in response to the state's respondent's argument. However, I would say that the cases that we're relying on in the language of those cases defining what the prior record of delinquency means has been argued throughout the case. And so I'm talking about the NJS and the KAP cases. Those are cases that have been argued throughout the case in discussing what it means for these records to come in. And in fact, in the state's initial motion to have these pre-offense petitions considered that caused the district court to order these evaluations to be done again, the state was relying on NJS. And so that is a case that has been discussed throughout as far as the court's dicta. But there's no case law on either side of that prior issue.
But explain why we wouldn't treat the argument about the definition of prior as forfeited by not having formed it until the reply brief. Was it, I mean, those issues about what prior meant, I mean, if it matters, it, that was a concern that was there back in the district court and at the time of the appellant's moving brief. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Judge. I do not believe that issue was forfeited. The defense did object to the inclusion of those petitions for the reports in this case that were completed by both of the experts. So it's the state that moved for them to be included. The defense did object to their inclusion on numerous grounds. However, there was
But if this wasn't one of those grounds, why would we not treat it as? If we were to say, no, this is a case where we're going to consider the argument, even though we've got all this case law about forfeiting arguments and arguments not being considered if they're raised for the first time in a reply brief, what would be the, why is this case the exception?
Judge, I would consider it analogous to the arguments that have been made regarding the phrases like the cluster of offenses and the pattern of offenses. And it's analogous to that because when we're talking about a cluster of offenses, it's not considered to be prior conduct. And that is what the expert Tricia Aiken argued or presented to the court, is that these offenses all occurred at generally the same time without any court intervention, and therefore do not make PB more of a public safety risk when we're looking at factor number three. And that was litigated extensively, and that is the phraseology that had been used previously, was referring to cluster offenses, meaning not considering those unadjudicated offenses separately in that analysis of factor three. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate hearing from you today. The conversation's been really helpful to us. With that, this matter is now submitted to the court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.